Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. More than 10 years ago, I interviewed Betsy Leander Wright about her superb book, Missing Class. And today we'll visit with her about the book she researched and wrote with Jesse Strybe called Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Why Red and Blue White People Disagree in How to Decide in the Gray Areas. As in all her work, Betsy drills deep past prejudices and proclivities, beyond entrenched sides and blinded perspectives, to find a better way forward for all of us. It's such a fertile discussion that there is a full uncut version of this interview on northernspiritradio.org with more than 20 extra minutes of engrossing discussion. Thanks to Andrew Jansen for production assistance today. Right now, Betsy Leander Wright joins us from Arlington, Massachusetts via Zoom. Betsy, it's great to have you back for Spirit in Action.
Great to be with you, Mark.
The title of your book makes it clear in the subtitle of your book. The book is, again, Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Why Red and Blue and White People Disagree and How to Decide in the Gray Areas. You missed a great opportunity, I want to say, visually. The phrase, why red and blue white people, you've got red in red and you've got blue in blue. You couldn't put white in white because it's a white cover. I think you needed to make a black background to the letters. White.
Okay.
I'm sorry. It's just a major failing of the book. Don't read it, folks. That's a big fail. No, okay. I'm wrong. And you did this book along with Jesse Strybe and you, Betsy Leander Wright. What's the connection with Jesse? What's your part in the book?
Jesse and I know each other through sociology circles. We became friends when we noticed that at national conferences, we would show up at the same panels in the audience because we're both interested in a lot of issues related to inequality, and not the money part, not the economic part of inequality, but the cultural part. So we're both scholars of social class culture differences. So this is in both of our wheelhouse. How do white people think differently than each other about racism and sexism? And it grew out of a conversation a few years ago where she was saying that she keeps getting into these conversations, as I think we all do, where something was so clearly racist to her, and then the other person just didn't see it that way, or sexism, or vice versa. And I said, me too, that more commonly I see the racism or sexism and the other person doesn't. But sometimes someone says, oh yeah, that's really racist or that's really sexist. And I'm like, wait, I don't see it. So we thought, you know, what's going on there? What's behind these really, really different perspectives? And we knew from the polling data and everything that white Americans' perspectives in particular have polarized, that there's more and way more than 10, 20 years ago, white people who think there's a lot of racism and there's a lot of sexism in our country. And there's a lot more who are like, no, there isn't. And they're wanting to really make a point of we are past racism and sexism in our country. So we're like, okay, this is a mystery. We need to find out what's going on, what changed. And how can people arrive at such different conclusions? So we knew from the beginning we were going to study white people who have changed more than other races and ethnicities, and that we were going to explore possible explanations for who is it that disagrees with each other so much and why.
And you say a few years ago that you and Jesse were talking about this, but in fact, you started doing the interviews before COVID and into COVID. So therefore, it must be at least 5 years. You're losing track of time there, Betsy.
It takes a long time to do a study like this. So we did 127 interviews we started in 2017, then 18. Wait, is that right? Because they went into, maybe it was 2018, 2019, and then they went through 2020. Yeah. And until the COVID shutdown, we met with people in person. Jesse is a professor at Duke University in North Carolina. So she did the Southern interviews. And then I did around the Northeast, as I was saying. So we each did about half. We had one research assistant who did a few. And then it takes a long time when you've got these thousands of pages of transcripts to go through and figure out, to see the patterns. Sociological research is like so much fun because of that. That there's so much you don't catch when you're doing the interviews or just looking into the research questions, and then these patterns start emerging when you analyze it. So we both did the analysis, we both did the writing and trying to get a publisher, and now the book is out and we're both promoting the book and writing things based on it. So it's been a lovely experience working with her. She's a wonderful person.
I think that sociology must not be for people who are ADD, going through that, those kind of volumes of information.
Well, there is software that helps you. You don't have to hold all the data and all the patterns in your head. The software will help guide you, but it is a really, really big mental process, and it's a long process. We're really proud of it. I think it's more astonishing to me because I haven't written as many books or just one other sociological book. And for her, this is one of many. Her work is very interesting, mostly about social class differences, like her brilliant, brilliant book called Power of the Past about mixed class couples. She interviewed people where there's one working class background partner and one, grew up college educated parents and so forth, professional managerial. So anyway, I was already a big fan of Jessie before we made friends and before we launched into this project. And she's a beautiful writer. I can say, as for people who read the book, every time that there's a paragraph that has an enormously long list of examples or something, that's Jesse's writing. Because I don't feel secure enough to do that. I would have broken those out into separate sentences and paragraphs, but she feels like she can pull it off. So I was like, okay, Jesse, I get it.
I want to make sure our listeners know that there's a couple places you can connect both with Jesse and Betsy and about the book. The book is from Stanford University Press, but Jesse has written a number of books, as you were saying, Betsy. Go to jessestribe.com. Jesse is Jessi. Stribe is Streib. JessieStribe.com. Of course, the link's on NordenspiritRadio.org, and you can also follow her column on Forbes. So there's all those places. And Betsy, of course, the first time I interviewed you was back, I think, in 2011. Your website, classmatters.org, related to that interview that I did about it. Was it your master's, PhD thesis that it came out of, the missing class?
Missing Class was my PhD dissertation turned into a book. So, yeah, there's links to that on classmatters.org. I actually think I talked to you earlier than that about my non-academic book called Class Matters, that there's also links to there. That came out in 2004.
Missing Class, by the way, folks, is wonderful. I can't tell you how many times since that interview, what, 14 years ago, when I've brought up topics from, like, humor is different between social class activists and how this works. There's riches in there. So you can listen to my interview on the NordenspiritRadio.org website, or you can go track her down. Classmatters.org is where you find Betsy Leander Wright. But one other thing I wanted to mention is two previous full interviews I've done with you. One was in March of 2014. The second one was in March of 2020. And now this one is going on the air in March of 2025. There must be something about March that's significant. Where does it play in your universe?
The Ides of March, I guess. I don't
I don't know. But back to the book. One thing I was going to comment about. Medical studies usually try and have thousands or tens of thousands of people in the study. Millions are even better. A sample size of 127 is not the same, but you're analyzing things, you're drilling down into people's heads, I think, as opposed to just what their DNA is or something objective or easily numerable, right?
Right. Those are the ones that where you need to have usually thousands or hopefully millions is quantitative studies. It's hard to do statistics with a small number like what we did, but this is a good size sample for qualitative, where you have a lot of people's words, You recorded interviews with them, you learn their life story, you can hear their tone of voice, and then you look for patterns. And this is a fine size for the kinds of patterns we were looking for. We had a hypothesis that these disagreements that so many of us have with somebody in our family or our workplace or online about what's racist and what's sexist, we had a hypothesis that the ways of thinking about racism and sexism might vary by social class, which is what we're both scholars of. Turned out to be wrong, or mostly wrong. We thought that opinions about gender, about sexism, would vary by gender. We were mostly wrong about that. We thought region, that she would hear, more what's affiliated with conservative points of view in interviewing people around the South, including rural and small town South, as well as her liberal area, and that I'd hear it would be different, the ways of talking about racism and sexism in the North, where I am, around New England and New York, would be different. And we're mostly wrong about that. So you listen for, like, who says things that are similar, not just the yes or no question, is it racist or sexist, but what's the thinking behind it? What's the method of approaching the question? We really found that the only difference is political affiliation, that the people who tended to vote Democrat approach these questions really different than the people who tend to vote Republican. And then we have, of course, lots and lots of independents and people who mostly don't vote, and that some of them thought differently also. So we ended up needing to read a bunch of political science for, like, what goes on when people affiliate with a political tribe so much that it affects their answers to. We were asking all, we asked about two dozen questions that were about, is such and such racist or such and such sexist with current events and things in their lives? And then we showed these storyboards, we showed these cartoons, and told little fictional stories and asked if they saw racism or, in some cases, sexism in the story. And yeah, we ended up learning a lot about how people approach those questions and if they have a pre-existing ideology, how their thinking process arrives at the thing that they already believe to be true.
So I was going to ask you, and I think you maybe just answered this, why race and why sex as opposed to class, hair color, nationality, height, sexiness, weight, ugliness? I mean, there's many ways that people make their judgments, and this is all about judgments, right?
Yes.
So why race and sex?
Those are two types of inequality, two social identities, where public opinion has polarized very dramatically, and where really most people do have opinions. I don't think that would be true if we both have asked people questions about social class before. People aren't as opinionated. The impetus for the study was we knew that the prominence of disagreements about racism in particular had risen. We were doing this after the first wave of Black Lives Matter movement, and then we kept doing the interviews into the big wave in 2020. And just about everybody, every American, has opinions about that. And similarly with Me Too and issues about the gender pay gap, there had been lots and lots and lots of news coverage recently, before we started the interviews, on these two issues. They're both extremely important issues. They're inequities that disadvantage millions of people in our country. And they were both issues that had been picked up by the media. The amount of coverage of racism and sexism in the mainstream media had ballooned enormously in the recent years before we started the study, and also on the fringy right-wing media, the saying, we are not a racist country, we're not a sexist country, that had become this very familiar trope in the Fox News and the right-wing bloggers and podcasters and so forth. And similarly, the two major political parties had both started talking about racism and sexism much more than in prior decades. We have numbers of mentions within the political party platforms, within the media covering the politics, that are, they both rose sort of exponentially. And, of course, we're curious what everybody thinks about this, of every race, but we knew that it was white opinions that had diverged the most. And Jesse and I are white, and we focused on our particular curiosity about white public opinions on these two increasingly prominent types of inequality.
And since you started the research on this over 7 years ago, things have only grown. I mean, in the book, you mentioned some stuff about questions about DEI, and the past month has blown that out of the water, just made it crazy. Whereas there used to be some kind of an easy working with it consensus. Easy, maybe not quite easy, but not near as polemical. This past month, that's become right through the roof.
Yeah, we feel like our book is suddenly even more relevant than it was before. And just the fact that DEI, so many people now know that acronym that didn't before. And there is this outburst of hostility in high places to mentioning race or gender, or especially efforts to reduce inequalities. We hope that the book will be a force for good in people, doubting why would you ban education about racial inequality, gender inequality? Why would you ban that? Why would you dismantle the offices or institutions whose job it is to respond to discrimination, given that we know both race and gender discrimination happen a lot in our society? Yeah, we feel like, sadly,
Your relevance.
we're suddenly relevant. And so many people, I feel like the number one question that I've been asked since people heard what the book is about or started to see the publicity about it or read it is like, what goes on in the heads of Trump voters? Are they all really racist and sexist? So I've been able to be this sort of source of hope of saying, no, actually, they're not as bad as you fear. That this really extreme denial of the continued existence of racism in particular, that's not where all Trump voters are coming from. And they're not mo the ones we talked to, of course, there's others we didn't talk to, but the ones we talked to who did say a lot of no's, they don't see racism in situations. They are not primarily motivated by hostility to people of color. We had one hostile real hater among the interviewees, but mostly a lot of the ideological conservatives are very mad at liberals, but they're not hostile to people of color. And it was very comforting to me because I am really alarmed of how could people know all these terrible things that Trump has done and still vote for him. It was very comforting to me to see that the people who, in general, said, no, there's not racism in this situation, in their lives, they do stick up for people of color being harmed or slurs against people of color. They have very, very narrow definitions of what racism is, and similarly with sexism. But when something does meet that definition, they do sometimes speak up against it or stick up for somebody. So that was reassuring to me.
I think I need to step back. And one question I didn't ask you explicitly, although, of course, having read the entire book, I do have some sense of it. You wrote the book. Is it racist? Is it sexist? Why red and blue white people disagree and how to decide in the gray areas. Is the objective of this book knowledge or is it change? Or is it something else? I mean, why do this study? Why do this book? You're an academic, so therefore maybe knowledge serves its own purposes, but I have a feeling there's bigger objectives than that.
Yeah, I'm an academic and an activist. Yeah, I would say that knowledge is good, but also dialogue. We're hoping that the book enables people to talk with people they disagree with about the race and gender issues more constructively, to understand where they're coming from. Persuasion works best when it's based on shared values. And we hope it'll enable people to find common ground with people that they disagree with on whether such and such, whether something in their lives or their workplaces or whatever is racist or sexist. So that's one is dialogue. And the other is change. That we found a lot of flaws in how people reasoned, how people came to their conclusions of something isn't racist or sexist or something is. And we're hoping that people self-reflect on how do they reach their judgment calls and make better judgment calls, and because they make better judgment calls, can be more of a force to reduce sexism or racism. That's the last chapter, is our recommendations of what do we think would be good ways when you're in a gray area and somebody's like, oh, everybody's canceling this celebrity because they said this offensive thing, or oh, people are upset at who got promoted and who didn't in our workplace, or People are wondering just how offensive is Uncle Joe? Wherever you are, that the questions come up, because they come up for all of us all the time. Once you start looking for it, you realize you're called upon to make a judgment call of is something racist or sexist more frequently than you're probably noticing. We want people to go in with an intent to make things fair. And so to come up with really well-grounded judgment calls and then to work with other people about making change.
We're going to get into more of that detail as we continue talking with Betsy Leander Wright about the recent book that she co-wrote with Jesse Strieb called Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Why Red and Blue White People Disagree and How to Decide in the Gray Areas. I've talked to Betsy twice before, and you'll find them on our website, northernspiritradio.org. 20 years. This is the 20th year I'm doing this program. And so there's a lot of material out there, both for Song of the Soul and Spirit in Action. We have links to all of our guests. And so when you want to track down Betsy Leander Wright, come to our site. You can find the link to classmatters.org. You'll find a link to the book via Stafford University Press, and you'll find a link to jessiestribe.com and her Forbes column as well. So all of that's on Northern Spirit Radio, including all of the different radio stations that carry our programs across the country. Right now, there's some 35 stations that carry our programs across the U.S., with California being the largest carrier of our programs, but they're all over the place. And Massachusetts is not doing badly where Betsy is from. So come to our site, comment on this show when you visit it. We love two-way communication. I can't stress that enough, and I don't think most people are interested in that. I also like to think that we do slow radio here, time to really talk in depth. That's not your experience on every station, is it, Betsy?
Oh, lots of short interviews, but it's wonderful how you do these nice long in-depth interviews, Mark.
As a sociologist, you would appreciate it that way. If you were an economist, maybe you wouldn't be so excited. I don't know. But anyway, that's on northernspiritradio.org. Please remember also to donate to support us. One of the key things that we've done here for Northern Spirit Radio is to not accept money from corporations or government, which means we don't have to toe any line that they have. We're trying to support our listeners, actually, and healing of the world. Those are our two big goals. So please donate to support us. It's hard these days, I think, because there's so many political, especially this past year, political people saying, donate, we need it now. This is going to make the election or not. And I think a lot of people have felt very drained, but you can find out how to donate via northernspiritradio.org. Again, we're talking with Betsy Leander Wright. Let's go into some more of this detail. We're talking about acquitters and convictors. Are these sociological terms, or are these Betsy and Jesse terms?
They're Betsy and Jesse terms. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things you do in qualitative analysis. You have all these interviews, you're thinking about the similarities and differences in what people said, and then a metaphor springs to mind of what would characterize the different things you're hearing. So no, we made up the terms, we made up the courtroom metaphor after we had talked to so many people, and we made up the terms acquitter and convictor. And then each of those broad categories, the acquitters are the people who said, no, it's not racist, it's not sexist. The convictors, yes, it is. Each of them broke into two groups. So we actually have four categories. We found that a subset of each were very ideological about their beliefs about racism and sexism. So we call them the motivated acquitters and convictors because there's a theory called motivated reasoning that we all do where you have pre-existing beliefs and you absorb information in a way that reinforces those, and you have ways of thinking where you arrive at the conclusion that feels right to you or that your tribe believed. So about half of our interviewees really identified with one of the political tribes or another, that they called themselves liberals or conservatives, or they affiliated with the Democratic or Republican Party. They listened to a lot of partisan news sources, but most people didn't. And I think that's true of our country too. We think of these very polarized people, but a lot of people don't belong to a party, don't even vote. And so we called them the moderate acquitters and convictors. Their tone was calmer, typically. their judgment calls were not as consistent. In some cases, the moderate acquitters, they mostly said no, but in some cases they'd be like, okay, yeah, actually that is kind of racist or kind of sexist. And similarly, the moderate convictors would occasionally say, no, I guess that's not really racist or sexist. And one place I said we didn't find big, there's no class correlation with who's an acquitter and who's a convictor, which surprises people because there's a stereotype about working class people being more racist and sexist. I don't think is true by and large, but the moderate convictors were disproportionately working class. They were people who hadn't had the opportunity to study a lot about big issues in our society, but they were tending to bring up examples from their lives. So, for example, in the case that I mentioned about the guy who says to his female doctor, "Hi, nurse," in the hospital, it was the moderate convictors, a lot of whom who had worked in working class jobs in hospitals or healthcare facilities, were the ones to say, "Yeah, I saw that with my own eyes." They tended to be more right out of their own experience. So they knew that there was a lot of racism and sexism based on life experience, but they didn't necessarily know a lot about the broader patterns.
I do love the stories that go with these ideas that you're presenting in the book. You're talking about here's this woman, the way you characterized the interviewees, and of course, names are changed and there's other things to protect their identity, but was sexually abused, worked this store when you really have a feeling of talking to a real person as you go through that in the book.
Yeah, we tried to make the people come alive. These are not just statistics, but they're real humans. And we tried to really learn their backstory so that we could humanize them. And so you could see how their opinions were formed. So the people that were the motivated acquitters, that were ideologically conservative, often very right-wing, very angry at liberals. One thing I learned about them that humanized them for me is an awful lot of them had some kind of trauma in their background. That some of them had been combat veterans injured in the military. Some of them, as you mentioned, had been sexually abused or had a battering relationship. That they pride themselves on their toughness. Their very right-wing denial of racism and sexism, in part, was feeling like, why are people so touchy about verbal things? Because it's a rough world out there, and terrible things have happened to me and people I know. So, by their definition, if somebody's not really hurt, so that came up when we would ask about Confederate statues being taken away, that people are taking them down or renaming Confederate sites, that two of the motivated acquitters said things about, like, a 150-year-old statue can't hurt you. And one's like, if you're focused on statues, you must not have any really big problems. But symbolic things just were like, no. But when it came down to it, I want to tell a story about one of the interviewees who really opened my eyes to people that I mostly disagree with. I disagree with people voting for Trump. Not going to be a force against racism or sexism, that's for sure. So Jesse interviewed a longtime diner waitress that we gave the pseudonym Alice to. She grew up low income, had worked this wage job her whole life, and she could produce every single Republican and Fox News talking point. She thought, there's not a lot of racism out there. That's ridiculous. So she's like, why can there be black entertainment television and not white entertainment television? And Black Lives Matter is just as bad as the Ku Klux Klan because they're against a certain race and they don't let white people in. She had a lot of misinformation like that, but you could see where she had picked it up, given what her media sources were. So I was like, okay, I'm going to really disagree with this person. And then when Jesse drew out her life story, Alice's best friend, an African American woman, was incarcerated with a long sentence. And Alice took in her friend's daughter and raised her until the girl was 17, so about a decade. And that part didn't surprise me because I think conservative deniers of racism are nice to individual people of color. That didn't surprise me. But the part that surprised me and kind of blew the lid off my brain was that when Alice's mother said to her, "As long as that N-word girl is in the house, I'm not coming into your house," Alice cut off her mother and others in her family and sided with her foster daughter against her own relatives. And I thought that was really a bold stand against racism, that she wasn't going to have it the way her mother talked and behaved. And I think a lot of us, liberals who pride ourselves on being anti-racist, we haven't sacrificed something as big as Alice sacrificed. So I admire what she did with her mother. And I think she and others, seeing the concrete actions against racism or sexism that the very conservative ideological acquitters did, and then seeing the bad habits among the convictors whose definitions I agree with more, it scrambled my brain. I think white people, it's very important that we speak up against racism. That, I'm a member of Showing Up for Racial Justice Surge, which that's our mission. I think it's really important that white people speak up and stand up against racism. And I am no longer as sure who will do that on the left, right, red, blue spectrum. I think there's potential allies all over the spectrum, including there at the far right wing. So that's a hopeful thing I took from the research, and I hope it'll be a hopeful thing that people take from the book.
You know, Betsy, as you talk about all these things, I've got 1,000 questions and reactions coming up. One thing, by the way, I wanted to say, congratulations. You and Jesse formed a hypothesis and you found out you were wrong. So you changed. And that is an example that we need to do. As we know, Donald Trump does not say ever he was wrong. And that is a big, big problem in this world. The moderate folks on your scales, what they're willing to do that gives me hope is they're willing to look at additional evidence and say, no, I guess I was wrong. I disagree with what I thought there. So that's one very important thing. You also talked about racism over the years, and you're talking about veterans and so on who say, get over it. It's just a word or it's just a statue, right? That kind of thing. I was reflecting back over the work, getting rid of slavery and getting rid of segregation, the civil rights movement. And there's a transition that happened in my lifetime. I was born in 1954, and in the 1980s, we went from an MLK kind of nonviolent approach to black power, the whole, all that happened in the big cities and the whole racial strife. And with black power, there's like, no, we've got to separate from whites and blacks because we'll never be able to get along. That wasn't MLK's message at all. Things have continued in the decades since where we're talking about things like microaggressions or white fragility and so on. And there's a lot of conservative reaction against those things, even though they might actually have liked what MLK stood for. Not at the time. At the time, they were plenty oppositional to it. There's a question that I came up with respect to race and sexism, and I imagine there's sociological studies out there about outcomes of this, is recognizing of and embracing of, shall we say, victimization. Does that help good outcomes or does it decrease them? There's the thing that happened, you used to call them victims of sexual assault, and we switched to calling them survivors of sexual assault, which victimization as an identity, I think, can actually be counterproductive in terms of where you actually want to go. Are there studies that show what is effective in moving things forward?
Yes, lots and lots. And there's a lot of components in there, a lot of threads you've started there. This gets to the misconceptions about diversity, equity, inclusion work and what happens on college campuses and what happens in workplaces. The idea that the outcomes of participating in DEI activities is to make people of color or women or gay people or whoever it is that's clustering, to make people feel like victims and disempowered. Like, really, nothing could be more untrue than that. That having separate spaces where you're just with people of your own identity that's marginalized on your campus, your workplace, that's well proven to have very positive effects, including the most rigorous study of DEI programs, that's what works, the supportive spaces. And then the idea that white people or men or whoever's in the, or straight people who's in the dominant position is going to be made to feel self-hating and guilty, like this preposterous, we have to take the Black history books out of the elementary schools or else the white students are going to feel bad, like they're bad humans for being white. Like, yeah, that's just imaginary. That's not what really happens. And when I've been a sociology professor, I saw the reverse happen in both of these, that when you have multicultural programming and education about racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, and the people who are marginalized or targeted get to have their private places to meet before then rejoining the bigger community and being in bridge spaces. They come out, you know, empowered, ready to connect to the bigger community, proud of their identities. And this is something I've worked on a lot on class, that first gen and low-income students, when they get to have those spaces to talk with each other, they come back into the wider community proud and feeling powerful and a sense of efficacy, and they do better academically. And similarly, the people who get training to be allies, to be, you know, upstander training of like, what do you do when you hear a bigoted comment or when your colleague of color, your queer trans co-student is harassed? The students in the dominant identities, you can just see them growing into bigger people, being people who have the sense of agency and efficacy inside themselves to speak up against injustice. And that also is like, there's zero evidence that there's this terrible, like, oh no, I must hate myself now because I'm, I mean, I would, shouldn't say zero. I've heard of some really ridiculous messaging or workshops or something that does try to make people just disavow who they are. But that's really not the common thing. The common thing is DEI is having people have someplace to go when they're harassed or discriminated against, where they get support and don't get chased away from the college or the workplace, don't get disheartened, and where people learn about each other's cultures and where people get empowered to work together across differences, to speak up for against injustice. There's a lot of evidence of this. And people who've actually gone through DEI programs, the majority of them of any identity support it, want it to exist in their workplace. And so this demonization that this is reverse racism and sexism, this is reverse discrimination, you know, overwhelmingly that's not true. It's a myth, but it's a myth that's taken on, that it's been pushed so much by Republicans and right-wing media that a lot of people imagine, oh, they must have actually been spreading anti-Semitism there, or they must be spreading anti-white attitudes or anti-male attitudes. Wow, that sounds really horrifying. We better get rid of it. It's based on not knowing what really goes on.
Folks, Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Is a great book. You'll get great thoughts, insights, and hopefully it'll help our society progress against racism, against sexism, and really combining the red and blue sides, respecting each other and working together better. That's what I really hope comes out of this book. There's another great sociological book called The Phantom Toll Booth. Do you know that book?
I loved it when I was like 10 years old. That's my
Well,
favorite.
there's a wonderful item in there, and it relates to what I was just asking about. They're going on this crazy adventure, and impossible, unthinkable things happen as they go through. And there's a guy who pops in along the way, and he says, "There's one thing I'll tell you. I'll just tell you at the end, though." And they go through, and they get to the end, and they say they've gone and survived these incredible, impossible things. And they get to the end, and he says, "What was that thing?" He said, "Well, when I sent you off on the adventure, I didn't want to tell you that you won't, it's impossible to succeed." And because they didn't know that, they did succeed. And I think that there's a part of human psyche that works that way. As long as we believe it's impossible, as long as we believe this is going to be horrible, we will do worse. And I don't know sociologically if that's justified or not, but I think it's the way people work. And so one of the things that I have been doing in this time at my Quaker meeting, we've been talking about is not looking at the news every day and saying, oh, the world's horrible, this is bad, even though most of the things that are happening right now are very much counter to what I think is good for the world, and I think they're going to be destructive of the world, right? Even though I think that, focusing on that disempowers us. It leads us into depression and leads us into self-doubt. And I'm just wondering if sociologically that's proven or not.
Does hope lead you? I don't know a study like that. I'd like to read that study. Does focusing on the good news or optimism lead you to make more of a difference? I don't know that study. Well, there's a related thing. When we're talking about the actual impacts of diversity, equity, inclusion programs and that are now being demonized unfairly and banned, I was saying that there is some research, one very large study that looks at the actual outcomes in subsequent years of number of managers of color. And when they've done, you know, in prior years, done DEI programs. And then there's another review article that studies many, many different evaluation studies of DEI programs. And I read both of those, and they both say sometimes it backfires and causes resentment and doesn't work, and sometimes it really works well. All these studies came to the same conclusion, and I came up with a generalization that I see there, that the things that work really well are positively focused. So like I was saying, support groups for people, you know, who are in the minority and the marginalized identity within a college or a workplace. Support groups are positive. Affirming statements like saying diversity, we celebrate diversity at this workplace, or hanging your Black Lives Matter banner at your college. Things that affirm positive values have positive impacts. And mentoring programs, so that if there's a category of people, whether it's women in the sciences or people of color in academia, there's a category of people not getting promoted so much, if they create mentoring programs, and they can be open to anybody, but that those positively focused things, like we're going to give you support, we're going to give you help, we're going to celebrate how welcome the outnumbered or marginalized people are here, we're going to celebrate visually, verbally, how great it is that we have diversity here. Those positive things work. The things that backfire, and here I'm talking about the Frank Dobbin and Alexandra Kalev, I think you pronounce it, study, the biggest study of outcomes of DEI programs yet. The things that backfire are very negatively focused, setting up grievance procedures and punishments for behavior and legalistic workshops. This thing that became very common in the past decade in corporations of mandatory workshops led by lawyers. Here's what you have to do for our company not to get sued. Really negative results of that.
Oh, wow.
And DEI workshops that I've led or been a participant in, that's not the focus at all. The focus is let's learn about each other's cultures. Let's learn about the systems of oppression. Let's have a positive values in our company that we boost everybody. So I really was fascinated by that. And that seems related to your question that, yes, we need DEI, but we need positive. Let's boost people. Let's welcome people in. Let's do outreach so we have a diverse pool of applicants, and let's do outreach so that we have a diverse workforce and student body and whatever. And then let's boost people who might feel marginalized and might drop out as part of boosting everybody, of being an inclusive, welcoming community where people feel a sense of belonging. We know that's what works. So why that is being right now demonized, banned, people losing their research money or their student loan money or whatever, because they do that. This is a very, very dangerous backlash we're seeing.
Very clearly. I just had a thought as you were talking, and this relates to the removing of statues. There was a lot of pushback about removing these statues of people who supported the Southern secession, supported slavery, etc. And I was wondering how different the reactions and the effort would have been had the advocates of getting rid of the statue saying, we want to replace this statue with this hometown person who was on the right side of it. And so they could be actually championing something, and people would say, well, no, I don't want to oppose putting up a statue for this nice person. I think that the reactions would have been more muted in opposition to removing the statues.
I think that is happening in some cases.
I know we can't take all of your day, Betsy, but there are a couple things I want to do. Number one, I want to thank you for what you wrote on page 118. As a person who's sat in men's groups for now for, I guess it's been 34 years, so I've heard a lot of experience of men. And these are generally men who I would say are pretty conscious of sexism and that kind of thing. But there's this strength that comes from being heard by other men that has been very valuable. I read Warren Farrell's book along the way, The Myth of Male Power, which I said, wow, I've been denying my own experience. I know that experience. And when we shut ourselves down on page 118, you specifically address a number of experiences that men have of their own difficulties, frequently caused, by the way, by other men. I haven't found the stats on this yet, but I believe men are much more frequently victims of violence than women are, much more.
Public violence, not in the home.
Yeah, in relationship, because most men aren't married to men, so they don't experience.
But outside the family, men get more violence, yes.
Vastly more. I can tell you the number of times I've been punched, had a jaw that was swollen, couldn't eat for a week.
No.
All these things. And I'm a nonviolent person, right? So there's those things that get ignored because the only thing we have to worry about is take back the night. And it's absolutely important that we take back the night and all those things. I'm not in any way discounting what happens to women. But one thing that Warren Farrell said that just asked me the question, if we talk about racism, we know that African Americans in this country are discriminated against because their average lifespan is somewhere between 5 and 8 years less than white people. We hear that fact, we right away say, yeah, that's racialism, right? And that probably fits into people who are convictors who say that. And then we note that men on average live somewhere 3 or 5 years less than women. And we say that's because men are in charge. They have all the power. Wait a minute. There's something that doesn't jive. And that led me to question some things about my own experience. I just want to thank you for putting in those observations on page 118.
Yeah, I think Jesse was, but I can say for myself, I was influenced by the interviewees who raised things that are stacked badly for boys or men. And when I was saying big disagreements about the definitions of racism and sexism, the most liberal interviewees, the motivated convictors, were the ones that said, as I've always said, racism is just against people of color. If there's prejudice against white people, that doesn't count as racism, because even though it's rotten and harmful, it matters who has the most power in society. And similarly with sexism. But the other three of our categories, all the moderates and the motivated acquitters and the most conservative people, they all felt like, no, it's racism if it's against anybody, and it's sexist if it's against anybody, any harm based. So I don't know if I use the word sexism, but I definitely appreciate them, including the very conservative people that I often disagreed with, for raising the structural ways things are worse for men in our society. And I think boys and young men are in trouble right now. So, and elderly men too. The deaths of despair are mostly middle-aged white men. And the people who are sort of going off the rails and failing to turn into real adults are a lot of young boys and men, more than girls and young women. So who's been drafted, you know, who's harmed in combat more, who's more homeless, who's falling behind in educational attainment? There is a systematic inequity of some things harming males. And I think I, having talked to all my interviewees, I'm more aware of that. A lot of them were like, no, there's not sexism against women. There's sexism against men. And then they would tell their own custody stories or alimony stories. Like, I was a great dad. She was an addict. And she got the kids because she's the mother. That's not fair. And of course, I don't know their family situation, but I'd be like, huh. And so we looked it up. The book has fact checks at the bottom of the page.
And I love those.
We looked it up. It was like, no, it's still really true that custody and alimony are not completely based on the facts of the situation. They are based on gender. So yeah, I think I changed my views. And whether I label it sexism or not, I do think there are structural disadvantages of men happening that we need to change, because there's some very bad outcomes.
There's one thing I don't think we mentioned particularly in the interview, and I think we need to address it, Betsy, before we hang up. There is more in this interview than is going to fit in my 55-minute broadcast. I will have on my website the full uncut version as well. But the last chapter of the book is about the surveyor method, that we switch from being in the courtroom, convictors, acquitters, and you and Jesse say that perhaps the best way is the surveyor method. Please tell our listeners what that is, because that's where we need to move to improve the world.
Right. Instead of a courtroom, we say a metaphorical construction site. So land surveyors, wonderful profession, they do three things. And that by analogy that we think we all should do in order to reduce the amount of unfair inequalities in our society. So first, surveyors know a lot of geology and they have those scopes that can survey the whole landscape. So that's equivalent to learning the patterns of inequality, learning how our institutions and our culture disproportionately harm people of color, women, other marginalized people. And so you need to have that big picture of the landscape. Second, surveyors poke the ground of the very site. What's under this construction site? And so when there's a question of, is a situation racist, sexist, whether that's in our families, in our workplaces, online, when there's a possibility that something might be racist or sexist, besides knowing the big pattern of what tends to happen, you need to investigate the evidence of the case. You need to gather the facts before you make any judgment calls. Because only by putting together the patterns and the evidence of the case can you make a good judgment call. But then third thing that surveyors do is they work with the architect and the construction crew to build a nice, strong building. And so that's the most important step is whatever you find in your investigations about possible racism and sexism, you can work with other people to make that setting fairer in the future. So that's the surveyor method. That's what we spend the last chapter. And we have some stories in there of some very admirable surveyors.
I'm tempted to say that this book is perfect, but I found an error in the book, and I have to call you out on this.
Okay.
Open up your book to the page 104,
Uh-oh.
and there's a footnote at the end. Yes, I read footnotes, believe it or not. This is part of these clarification statements that you have. It's C, the last line of it. And it talks about something that did happen, the sentencing disparity between crack and cocaine that happened. You have the sentence there. The sentencing disparity was ended by President Obama in 2008. He was elected in 2008. He didn't even start as president till 2009. You are wrong, and that therefore.
Oops. Right, that date must be wrong. It was ended by him, but why?
Right. It was just a
We
year
tried to be
later. It
accurate.
was the next year. It was
Oh,
you're off by a few months.
I'm sorry. We really worked at these because we figured this book is going to be read by undergrads and other people who don't know a lot about and might think, well, gee, these people disagree which side is correct because there was a lot of disagreement on facts. So we tried to, we put not at the end of the book where you might not see it, but we put the background facts. The fact checks are at the bottom of the page so you can see. And we really, really worked at those. And mostly, I think I can really stand by them, but we put the wrong date on that one. So,
I
second
think you're
edition.
just off by a few months, as I said.
Yeah, I'll pass that on to Jesse.
I mainly just told you that to prove to you that I am a thorough reader and I do look carefully consider the evidence. And maybe my listeners for Spirit in Action know that about me. I am open to being corrected myself. I do hope that folks, you'll listen to this interview with Betsy Leander Wright about is it racist, is it sexist, why red and blue white people disagree, and how to decide in the gray areas, that you'll follow my post to jessestribe.com and to classmatters.org for Betsy, and to the link to the book. I hope you'll get it and read it, take it in, and consider whether you and those around you, and hopefully end up having more commonality with your neighbors so that we can all work together for the best life forward for all of us. I hope you'll do that. Betsy, thank you so much for your writing again. Your book way back in 2011 when I interviewed you about missing class was so wonderful. You're very inspirational to me in the work you do. I'm so grateful that you joined me here today for Spirit in Action.
I'm grateful for the chance to talk at such length and such detail, and for your very thoughtful questions and stories from your own life. That's a really wonderful opportunity.
So remember, folks, all the links and connection for the book and to Betsy and Jesse are on NordenspiritRadio.org. Please check us there, post a comment, consider donating, and join us next week for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on NordenspiritRadio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.